Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe received the rare honor of addressing a joint meeting of the United States Congress today as he continues his week-long trip to the United States. In his address, which is still currently going on at this moment, Mr. Abe spoke about Japan's wartime past.
Feelings of deep remorse over the war. Our actions brought suffering to the peoples in Asian countries.
Mr. Abe is the first Japanese prime minister to ever address a session of both houses of Congress. Prime Minister Abe was a guest of honor Tuesday night at a glamorous state dinner in the White House East Room. The United Nations says it's beginning to distribute food and medicine Wednesday in the area near the epicenter of Saturday's earthquake in Nepal, where the death toll has climbed past 5,000. The World Food Program's efforts around Gorkha came as Nepalese officials pledged Wednesday would bring improvements in the government's response for those in need of food, water, and shelter. Meanwhile, search and rescue workers are continuing picking through the rubble caused by the magnitude 7.8 quake. Election authorities in Togo have declared incumbent President Farenasingbe the provisional winner of Saturday's election, continuing his family's longstanding hold on power. The Election Commission chairman announced Mr. Nasingbe got about 1.2 million votes, or 59%, with leading challenger Jean-Pierre Fabre second with about 35%. This is VOA News. The government of Niger says 46 soldiers and 28 civilians were killed over the weekend as troops battled Boko Haram militants for control of an island in Lake Chad. Officials said Tuesday that 156 militants were also killed in clashes, which began after Boko Haram assaulted the island Saturday. Meanwhile, Niger's army says it has since retaken control of the island. South Korea's spy agency says North Korea's young leader, Kim Jong-un, has ordered the execution of 15 senior leaders this year. Seoul spy officials provided that information to lawmakers during a private session of parliament on Wednesday, according to a lawmaker. One of the executed officials was said to be a vice minister for forestry who was killed after complaining about Mr. Kim's forestation plan. The information, however, could not be confirmed. Saudi Arabia's King Salman bin Abdulaziz has reshuffled a number of top posts Wednesday. Edward Uranian has that story.
Amid a wave of turmoil in the Arab world and serious threats to the future of his nation and his family's dynastic rule, Saudi King Salman has announced sweeping leadership changes. Prince Mukrin, the former crown prince and one of the final surviving sons of the kingdom's founder, Abdulaziz ibn Saud, was replaced by Prince Mohammed bin Nayef. King Salman also named his own son, Mohammed bin Salman, deputy crown prince in a move to bring in new blood. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
U.S. economic growth slowed sharply in the first 3 months of this year. Wednesday's report from the Commerce Department says the gross domestic product expanded at an annual rate of just 0.2%. That is much slower than the 2.2% rate of the last quarter of 2014. Economists blame the slowdown on unusually foul weather and a strike that stopped shipping in the usually busy U.S. West Coast ports. The Baltimore Police Commissioner says the eastern U.S. city is stable as authorities enforce an overnight curfew after Monday's riots over the death of a young black man who died in police custody early this month. Police in riot gear confronted a small group of protesters who remained on the street in defiance of the curfew. However, television footage showed dozens of National Guard troops roaming the streets in military vehicles as the curfew took hold. Global press freedom declined last year to its lowest level in more than a decade. That's according to a report issued by Freedom House, that's an international human rights monitoring organization. The survey said journalists across the world face restrictions placed on them by forces including authoritarian governments. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyas Wuhi. And coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
and coming up today, we will have the European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker. He's expressed disappointment with the EU's plan to solve the Mediterranean migrant crisis.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Top story this hour. A Nigerian army spokesman says the nearly 300 women and girls rescued from militants this week will have physical and mental health exams. AP reports the army also is flying in medical and intelligence teams to question them. Colonel Sani Usman says the 200 girls and more than 90 women are traumatized after their captivity by Boko Haram. He said earlier that none of them was among the Chibok schoolgirls kidnapped a year ago. Usman now says that's yet to be determined. The women and girls were rescued from the 60,000 square kilometer Sambisa forest in northeast Nigeria. It's considered to be a Boko Haram stronghold. The Nigerian arm says three of the group's camps were destroyed. The rights group Amnesty International estimates Boko Haram has abducted more than 2,000 women and girls since the beginning of 2014. In related news, the government of Niger says 46 soldiers and 28 civilians were killed over the weekend as troops battled Boko Haram for control of an island in Lake Chad. It says 156 militants were also killed in the clashes. Niger's army says it has retaken control of the island.
The Nigerian government has released a long-awaited audit of the Bimot State Oil Company, NNPC. The audit states that Nigeria, Africa's biggest oil producer, needs to urgently overhaul the way it manages the company. Gillian Parker reports from Johannesburg.
Nigeria's President Goodluck Jonathan commissioned PricewaterhouseCoopers to audit the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, NNPC, last year. He acted after firebrand Central Bank Governor Lamido Zanusi alleged that the state oil company failed to remit roughly $20 billion in oil revenues to government accounts. A leaked letter from the bank governor to the president highlighted the missing revenues and alleged that NNPC was operating in violation of the law and its leadership could not be trusted. The allegations sealed Zanussi's fate. He was suspended. But the audit appears to support many of his allegations. The 200-page report from PwC, released by the Nigerian presidency on Monday, stated the NNPC model of operation must be urgently reviewed and restructured as the current model, which has been in operation since the creation of the corporation, cannot be sustained. The auditors said the company has a blank check to spend money without limit or control. Accounting and monitoring systems for oil revenue appear to be inaccurate and weak. The report said that data sets are beleaguered with significant discrepancies. For instance, PwC found a minimum of $1.48 billion in computation errors and unsubstantiated costs. Olushan Onuminde is co-founder of Lagos-based Budget, a non-profit organisation that analyses government budget figures. He says the NNPC is likely to owe even more to the Treasury and that another audit should take place once President-elect Muhammadu Buhari assumes office.
I think he has a political will strongly to do this. He is the first chairman of NNPC. He was even the Nigerian oil minister before. So he has a bit of understanding about this work. The only thing that I understand that certain elements in this part might also not be interested in this kind of reform.
Allegations of malpractice have hounded the NNPC for years. In 2012, former anti-corruption czar Nuhu Ribadu claimed that some $100 billion in oil and gas revenue had been diverted from the state between 2002 and 2012. but Nigeria's government managed to sidestep and bury the report. The audit will give momentum to the incoming government under Mr. Buhari, who during his campaign said that he wanted to lift the veil of secrecy shrouding the NNPC. Tolu Ogunlesi, a political commentator and journalist, says that change must be immediate and cannot be half-hearted.
This is the biggest slush fund in Nigeria. It's not going to vanish overnight. What the incoming government is going to find is that temptations to keep it and to continue to use it as previous governments have done, that temptation is going to be immense. What we have seen is that the NNPC would overwhelm any attempt to reform it.
One factor that may influence the debate is that the so-called slush fund is not as big as it used to be. The steep slide in oil prices over the past year has effectively emptied the government's coffers. Still, there is little doubt Mr. Buhari will have a tough time cleaning up a murky oil industry and the vested interests that benefit. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker has expressed disappointment with the EU's plan to solve the Mediterranean migrant crisis. European Union members agreed last week to double the number of ships and planes and triple the budget for Operation Triton, a search and rescue mission. Thousands of migrants have died in recent years trying to cross the sea in smugglers' vessels or fragile boats. Juncker calls the EU plan inferior. He says the EU should have increased funding a year ago for Italy's rescue operation known as Mare Nostrum. It's since been replaced by Operation Triton. He calls the decision a grave mistake. In related news, the Ethiopian government says it will take aggressive measures to end illegal migration. The Minister of Justice says penalties for smuggling will increase. Smugglers now face 5 to 20 years in prison and a $1,500 fine. Also, Ethiopia is seeking the release of 40 Ethiopian migrants held in a prison in Libya. The government says 190 Ethiopian migrants in Benghazi and Tripoli have requested to return home. It also wants to repatriate other Ethiopian citizens in Egypt and Sudan. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Ruhib, 13 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The government of Niger says 46 soldiers and 28 civilians were killed over the weekend as troops battled Boko Haram militants for control of an island in Lake Chad. And European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker has expressed disappointment with the EU's plan to solve the Mediterranean migrant crisis. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Demonstrations continue in Burundi for a fourth day today against President Pierre Nkurunziza seeking a third term in office. Demonstrators say a ruling party move to have the president seek re-election is unconstitutional. In response, the government has blocked all social media, including Facebook and Twitter. It has also shut down three radio stations and detained a human rights leader. Clashes continue between police and protesters. As many as five people have died in the unrest. The government confirms only two deaths. Assistant U.S. Secretary of State for Democracy Tim Malinowski left today for Bujumbura to seek a solution to the unrest. Yesterday, the government told envoys from the U.S. and other countries it was concerned that some diplomats were showing sympathy for the protesters. It told them to stay neutral in the conflict.
The Eastern region, this East Africa region, has responded to ongoing protests in Burundi with deafening silence following days of demonstrations against President Nkurunziza. The African Union has taken the lead on ending the political violence prompted by the president's decision to run for a third term. VOA's Gabe Jaslow reports.
4 days after protests broke out across Burundi, after at least two protesters were shot dead, and after the government closed down media houses in the country, Burundi's neighbors have yet to utter a word. There have been no official statements from Kenya or Uganda. Rwanda, which has taken on more than 20,000 refugees fleeing the violence, also has remained silent. And the East Africa Community, a regional grouping of which Burundi is a member, has not yet released a statement. Sarah Jackson, the Deputy Regional Director for East Africa at Amnesty International, told VOA she would like to see a stronger regional response.
We would like to see concerted action from the East African community as well. Their silence is quite notable given the current situation. But it's also possible that they're working multilaterally through the African Union to have a continental level response.
The African Union announced Tuesday it is sending a high-level delegation to Burundi in an effort to ease tension in the country. The representatives have not yet been named. Jackson said Amnesty has welcomed the AU's involvement throughout the crisis.
We know that the African Union has been engaged behind the scenes on the situation in Burundi for some time. And we're pleased to see them take a more public approach to this work.
Burundi's Senate has asked the country's constitutional court to take up the issue at the center of the chaos, whether President Nkurunziza is eligible to run for another term. The president and his supporters argue that because he was elected by parliament in 2005, he can run again, since the constitution states the president must be elected through direct suffrage, interpreted to mean a popular vote. But protesters argue that this violates the 2000 Arusha Accord, an agreement that ended the country's civil war and explicitly limits the president to two terms in office. AU chairperson Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma has welcomed the decision to take the dispute to court. AU spokesman Jacob Eben said Tuesday the chairperson has always maintained the matter should be settled by Burundi's own legal processes.
The very strong recommendation of the chairperson is that they should approach those institutions. There is a constitutional court in Burundi that whatever issues of understanding or misunderstanding or interpretation should be taken to that institution.
Protests continued around Bujumbura Wednesday, but with less intensity than in previous days. The government, which already closed down several radio stations broadcasting in the country, has also reportedly cut off access to social media messaging services, including Facebook and WhatsApp. Gabe Jaslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
Coming up on 18 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, the DRC's army says it has captured a key base of the Ugandan Islamist ADF rebels in the eastern DRC and killed an ADF chief of staff. Nick Long has more from Beni in eastern Congo.
The attack on this base was a continuation of Operation Sokola, an offensive against the ADF launched by the Congolese army in Beni territory in January 2014. Sokola means clean-up in the Congolese language Lingala. Most of the ADF's main camps were overrun in the first few months of the operation, and about 60 prisoners were taken. But United Nations experts concluded at the end of last year that the ADF had been weakened, not wiped out, and had lost few of its commanders. Since October, more than 300 civilians have been murdered in Beni territory in a series of massacres that have been widely blamed on the ADF and its allies. The DRC army, however, has now struck at the ADF's inner core, according to army spokesman Major Victor Massandi.
Les FARDC ont abattu dans la nuit du 24 au 25 avril au camp Baroukou.
He tells VOA that on the night of April the 24th and 25th, the Congolese army killed Kasada Kalume, a Ugandan national who was the number three person in the ranks of the jihadi Islamist ADF. DRC special forces reached the ADF camp at Baruku between the Bangu and Semliki rivers on April the 22nd and captured it after heavy fighting, according to the army.
Les corps de ses membres, dits noyaux durs, des ADF a été formellement identifié.
Masandi says Kasada's body was identified by a captured bodyguard to Sekou Baluku, the number two person in the ADF. He adds that Baluku and some of his lieutenants and dependents managed to escape from the camp during the fighting.
Les fardes sont découverts sur la zone de combat, quatre fosses communes remplies de cadavres.
The army found four common graves near the camp containing bodies of hostages, ADF casualties and dependents who were unable to flee, says Masandi. Local civil society officials say the ADF had kidnapped nearly 1,000 people in Beni territory since 2010. Common graves were found at several other ADF positions captured in the earlier phases of Operation Sokola. Various experts agree that by the middle of last year, the ADF had split into a number of small groups and had only a few hundred combatants.
Il y avait un noyau dur qui était dirigé par Jamil et secondé par Baruku.
Masandi says the movement had reorganized into an inner core led by the ADF's founder, Jamil Mukulu, and seconded by Sekou Baluku, with a coordinating headquarters headed by Kasada. He says there were eight satellite groups.
Les camps Baruku, constitués de 104 cases, étaient les quartiers généraux du noyau dur des ADF.
Masandi says the camp at Baruku consisted of 104 houses, including the headquarters, and was located inside the Virunga National Park in the foothills of the Rwenzori Mountains. He added that the Congolese army is more determined than ever to finish off the ADF. The UN mission in Congo, MONUSCO, has been supporting Operation Sokola with logistics, intelligence and the intervention brigade, comprised of Malawian, Tanzanian and South African troops. There have been rumours and press reports in recent days that ADF founder Jamil Mukulu has been arrested in Tanzania, but official sources in Uganda and the Congo have not confirmed these reports. Nick Long for VOA News, Beni.
In Togo, the opposition says it will contest provisional results from Saturday's presidential poll. Those results show President Faure Gnassingbé winning a third term. VOA's Anne Look has more with reporting by Modeste Mesavusa in Lomé.
2,066,997 voix, répartis comme suit.
Togo's Electoral Commission says President Faure Gnassingbé got just under 59% of votes against four challengers. Opposition leader Jean-Pierre Fabre got 35%. Fabre's party rejected the results as fraudulent Wednesday. The party says Fabre is the rightful winner by its count. Fabre says they will mobilize.
Ce coup de force là ne passera pas. Nous ne pouvons pas laisser des...
He says this coup will not stand. We cannot let people stay in power because they can do this. He says that time is over. They violated the law, Electoral Commission procedure, and the April 24th accord. He says we cannot accept it. International observer missions gave Saturday's poll marks of approval, but vote counting was held up by accusations of fraud from the opposition. Disputes over results of Togo's last two presidential elections led to violent protests. The Gnassingbé family has ruled the West African country for nearly 50 years. Gnassingbé Aiyedema took power in a military coup in 1967. He died in 2005, and his son became president. The president's supporters started celebrating after provisional results were announced late Tuesday. What we know is that we need peace, this man says. We've lived in peace for decades. We can see what this president has done for Togo since he arrived 10 years ago. Opposition supporters said they were disappointed, but not surprised.
Je peux dire que c'est pas étrange. Dans ce pays, on a toujours vécu la même chose.
This is not strange, this man says. It's always the same thing in this country. But we really need a change. Faure Gnassingbé has already had two mandates, he says. He should step aside and let someone else try. There are no term limits in Togo. The opposition tried and failed last year to add a two-term limit to the constitution. Anne Look, VOA News, Dakar.
The World Health Organization is trying to identify and isolate all remaining cases of Ebola in Guinea and Sierra Leone before the summer rains begin. Officials say the timing is crucial to stopping the spread of the virus in rural areas that will be inaccessible. Officials say the gradual decline in new cases in the two West African countries has leveled off. However, Liberia has had no new cases since March 27th. It could be declared Ebola-free if no new cases are discovered in the next 10 days. WHO says Ebola has killed nearly 11,000 since the outbreak began in Guinea in December 2013. The man who co-discovered the Ebola virus says more research is needed into whether the virus can be sexually transmitted. Dr. Peter Piot is with the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
A new report says global press freedom declined last year to its lowest level in more than a decade. Freedom House's annual survey says journalists across the world face restrictions by forces, including authoritarian governments, terrorists, and media owners with business interests. The worst offenders on the organization's ranking of 199 nations or terrorists are North Korea, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Belarus, Cuba, Syria, Iran, and Crimea. Norway, Sweden, and Belgium topped the list. Overall, Freedom House says just 14% of the world's population lives in free countries where coverage of political news is robust, the safety of journalists is guaranteed, state intrusion in media affairs is minimal, and the press is not subject to erroneous legal or economic pressures.
This year's Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement is being awarded to two scientists who have worked for conservation on the land and in the ocean, Indian Matav Godgill and American Jane Lupchenko. Michael Sullivan reports that both are being honored for working with communities to preserve the environment while protecting people's livelihoods.
Bamboo crops in the Western Ghats, a mountain range in western India, have been depleted by the paper industry, and Madhav Godgill says that hurts local villagers who rely on the plants to make baskets and other products. Godgill was trained at Harvard University and is now a visiting professor at India's Goa University, where he works with villagers to keep the ecosystem balanced and let the bamboo groves flourish.
Earlier, they were exploited through the state machinery, and largely they were auctioned off to industries. Now the communities have rights to manage these.
He says that for generations, villagers have preserved parts of the forest as sacred, something that also happens in other parts of Asia. Godgill says he serves as a bridge between local people and government, which wants to promote modern management techniques.
Documenting these sacred forests, kind of biodiversity resources that have been conserved, what is the traditional motivation, what is now in the current context possible.
Professor Godgill traveled to Los Angeles to receive the prestigious Tyler Prize and to meet this year's other winner, Jane Lupchenko. A marine ecologist, she teaches at Oregon State University and served 4 years as the head of the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Last year, President Barack Obama named her U.S. Science Envoy for the Ocean. Lupchenko has worked with American fishermen to restore depleted fisheries through a program called Catch Shares, which grants fishing rights to fishermen but puts limits on their catch in affected areas.
Our basic ideas of oceans is that they are so immense, so bountiful, that we could take anything out and put anything in and it wouldn't make much of a difference. And we've discovered that's simply not the case.
The system of catch shares gives fishermen a share of the ocean harvest, and those rights can be bought, sold, and traded. The system has its critics, but Lubchenko and other supporters point to its success in restoring depleted stocks. She says that limiting fishing on the high seas is difficult.
There are a lot of efforts underway to rein in overfishing, but it remains a huge challenge, and it has global ramifications.
She says governments must lead and local communities must be part of the solution. Madhav Godgill says the same is true of the Indian villagers with whom he works.
They have a substantial amount of understanding, local understanding of that resource base and what is impacting it, what might be good sustainable use practices.
The prize winners say the balance of life in the ocean and on the land is essential for a healthy planet and healthy communities. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impuga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The government of Niger says 46 soldiers and 28 civilians were killed over the weekend as troops battled Boko Haram militants for control of an island in Lake Chad. And the EU Commission president, he expresses disappointment with the U.S.'s plan to solve the Mediterranean migrant crisis. And coming up, music from Rwanda and in our feature segment, a look at the Migrant Offshore Aid Station, a private company focusing on the rescue of migrants from the Mediterranean. I'm Kim Lewis with Hayes Uhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off with African football.
Kim, joining us once again on the sunny side of sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, let's kick off with the African Olympic qualifying competition. As you know, David, Africa does have a proud pedigree in the Olympic men's football tournament, with neighbors Nigeria and Cameroon having won gold medals at past Olympic tournaments. What's the latest on the qualifying?
The long road, Sunny, to Rio de Janeiro began in Africa at the weekend with three first-round, first-leg qualifiers. Ghana, who have previously got bronze medals at the Olympics, they won 2-0 at home to Liberia. The match was played in Tamale in the north of the country. Mohamed scored in the first half and Ashia in the second half. Pretty predictable result this, Sunny. Maybe I thought Ghana would win by another goal or two. They generally have the edge over the Liberians. And I think the Liberians can be reasonably satisfied with this result, given, of course, the Ebola epidemic, which has seriously disrupted football in that West African country. A predictable result in Kigali and Rwanda. Rwanda 2, Somalia 0. Liberia have their problems with Ebola. Somalia, unfortunately, have their problems with violence. For decades now, it's been a lawless East African country. Recently, a government has been established. It's been backed up by military forces from the African Union. But unfortunately, because of the situation there, they cannot host matches. So the return game, in fact, will be played in Kenya. And on that issue of hosting, Sunny, Liberia too, they cannot, because of the Ebola situation, play in Monrovia. So the return game against Ghana will also be played in Tamale. And then in the final match, a big surprise, Botswana 3, Kenya 0. I'm afraid nothing but nothing is going right for Kenya these days. The clubs are struggling, the national team is struggling, and now the Olympic side. Yes, it was going to be difficult playing away to Botswana, but I never, ever envisaged it would be such a one-sided game. 3-0. Well, that's a big lead for Botswana going to Nairobi in a couple of weeks' time, and I think it's going to be a real challenge for the Kenyans to overcome that deficit. The return matches are scheduled for May 8, 9, and 10. And then if we look at what happens, in the case of Ghana and Liberia, the winners of that will play Congo-Brazzaville in the second round. The winners between Botswana and Kenya will play Zambia. And the winners between Rwanda and Somalia will play Uganda. Altogether, Sunny, there will be 3 qualifying rounds, and then you will have 7 survivors. Those 7 survivors will join Senegal in a tournament in Dakar between December 5 and 19. So 8 countries altogether. And the top 3 finishers, So in other words, the two winners of the semifinals, and then there's probably never, ever been a more important third-place match. These are often dismissed as really non-events of academic interest only. But in this case, there will be a prize of a trip to Rio at stake. So the winners of the two semifinals and the winners of the third-place playoff, they will go to Rio de Janeiro for the finals. And as you rightly said, Africa with a very proud record. Nigeria and Cameroon have struck gold. Nigeria have also won silver medals, and Ghana have won bronze.
David, one of South Africa's most popular clubs, Kaizer Chiefs, celebrating a trophy. How about some details for our VOA football fans?
Yes, Sonny, happy and sad. That has been the reaction of South African football fans. Delighted that Kaizer Chiefs have clinched the title, but the much hope for a thrilling finish to the season between Chiefs and Mamelodi Sundowns simply evaporated. Chiefs continued to win their matches, while Sundowns drew two and lost one. And in the end, it came down to the fact that Chiefs needed to beat Polokwane City, a side who are good in attack but very suspect in defence, in Soweto to clinch the title. And Chiefs took full advantage of that weak Polokwane defence. They scored four goals for the first time this season. They won the match 4-1. And our Zimbabwe listeners will be very happy to hear that Matthew Lisiki is a Zimbabwean. He scored two of Chiefs' four goals. So they now have an unassailable lead with 63 points. And the battle is on, Sonny, between Sundowns, Wits and Orlando Pirates for second place. And why second place is important is it gives you a ticket to the CAF Champions League. Turning to cup action in South Africa, we've had the semi-finals. Ajax Cape Town scored two late goals to defeat SuperSport United 2-1. And Mamelodi Sundowns found the going very tough indeed against second division Vasco da Gama, a club from Cape Town, before the superb goal by Mashaba from about 40 metres gave Sundowns a 1-0 victory. That match, Sonny, the final, will conclude the season on May the 16th in Port Elizabeth. Ajax Cape Town against Sundowns. They last met in the final in 2007, and the Cape Town club won by 2-0.
David, a somber note. The sunny side of sports remembers a former star for Kaizer Chiefs with the great nickname of Shoes, passes away at the age of 49. Your reflections, David.
Yes, John Shoes Mashweu, Soweto-born, Sonny, and at the age of 49, he has succumbed to stomach cancer. And that's quite a frightening thought for all of us here in South Africa, because if ever I knew a footballer who looked after himself health-wise, it was Shoes. He never drank alcohol. He never smoked tobacco. He really, Sonny, looked after himself so well. And I think it's quite sad that he has now succumbed to stomach cancer. He was a dribbling wizard. He was a member of the 1996 South African Cup of Nations winning team. One particularly remembers the semi-final against Ghana. This was seen as the ultimate test of this new young kid on the block called South Africa. They'd just come back from apartheid-induced wilderness. They were playing in the Cup of Nations for the first time, and they were up against the four-time champions, the Black Stars of Ghana. And I think the general feeling in West Africa was, well, South Africa, you've done well to get to the semi-finals, but now we're going to teach you a football lesson. That was a Ghana side, Sonny, that included the legendary Abede Pele. But on the night, South Africa were unstoppable. In fact, as I think back now, it was perhaps the greatest ever performance by Bafana Bafana. And one of the reasons for that great performance was none other than John Shoes Mashweu. He just had the game of a lifetime. He scored two of the three goals. He scored the first and the last goals in a 3-0 victory. It was a night really when South Africa could do no wrong. And Shoes was at his best, dribbling, shooting. The joke goes, Sonny, that the great dribblers of world football could beat somebody inside a telephone box, and that was Shoes. In fact, I remember he once told a South African defender who he met in the lift in Lagos in Nigeria that he wouldn't beat him once inside a telephone box. He would beat him nine times. Tributes, of course, Sonny, poured in. And Neil Tovey, the captain of that 1996 Cup-winning side, said Shoes was a dedicated footballer. He reminded me of a champion racehorse. He was lean. He was elegant. What he did on the field, he did extremely well. And that, Sonny, I believe, in just one sentence, sums it all up. A footballer who looked after himself. He played for a team called Mighty Blackpool. Unfortunately, despite their name, they weren't all that mighty. But eventually he moved to the great Kaizer Chiefs. He was then one of the first South Africans, post-apartheid, to move to Europe. He went to Turkey, and among the clubs he played for there were the great Fenerbahce. Of course, in Turkey, it's all about two clubs, Fenerbahce and Galatasaray, two clubs in Istanbul. And Hughes played there. He played there into his 30s, and that is seen as one of the great tributes to the footballer. You're at a stage when really you're drifting away from Europe and back to your homeland. He was still playing in Turkey at a very high level. He then came back to South Africa. He played for his beloved Kaizer Chiefs again, and he also played for AmaZulu. He played, Sonny, well into his 40s. That is how fit he was, and that was because he looked after himself so well. So he will be very sadly missed. A great footballer, a great servant of South African football.
Thanks, David. That was a nice tribute to the late South African football star John Shoes Mosheu. And David Legg was talking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
The Voice of America.
I'm Manny Pacquiao, the fighter from the Philippines.
Listen, when you're talking about the best fighter, you're talking about Floyd Mayweather.
Floyd Mayweather faces Manny Pacquiao Saturday night in what's being billed as the fight of the century. The welterweight showdown will take place at the MGM Grand Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada. It's a venue that staged many world championship fights over the years, but I don't know if any have received the attention and publicity of Mayweather Pacquiao. Both fighters made their official arrivals on Tuesday. Since Mayweather lives and trains in Las Vegas, I don't know how much of an arrival it was, but the money man was welcomed by the Southern University marching band and thousands of fans at the MGM Grand. The undefeated 38-year-old Mayweather thanked the fans for their support. Across the street at the Mandalay Bay Hotel, the 36-year-old Pacquiao was greeted by a smaller number of fans. The Filipino star told his supporters that he feels as good as he did 5 years ago.
I feel no changes in my body. I think the changes is I have more experience now than the 5 years ago. But the strategy, but the movement, the way you move is still there. The speed and power, like that. There's no changes.
Filipino boxing star Manny Pacquiao speaking in Las Vegas, Nevada. The Pac-Man will fight Floyd Mayweather Saturday night in a blockbuster welterweight showdown featuring the two biggest draw cards in boxing. I'm pleased to report that one of our big draw cards, our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moeta, will be ringside in Vegas for Mayweather Pacquiao. And we'll hear Namdi's thoughts on the big bout later this week. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to The Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of The Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, a look at a private company focusing on the rescue of migrants from the Mediterranean. And next, following the trial, the trail of refugees from Africa and the Middle East into Europe. But first, some music. Here's Kamachi from Rwanda with Rua Gaspo. Yeah, cuckoo, Kamachi from Rwanda with Rowa Gaspo.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights says the deaths of hundreds of migrants off the Italian coast this year were predictable, a failure of compassion on behalf of European Union leaders. The Migrant Offshore Aid Station is a private company in Malta founded last year by an American and Italian family to rescue migrants from the Mediterranean. Founder Martin Shriab tells Ricky Shryock they are now partnering with Doctors Without Borders to ramp up their search and rescue work.
This would be a very particular year for two very obvious reasons. The situation in Syria is deteriorating, and it's deteriorating fast. One other reason is the total security vacuum there currently is in Libya. Traffickers feel very much at ease in doing their business. They do their business with complete impunity. There are also a number of sub-Saharan Africans which continue, who have been leaving, again, their country of origin because they feel compelled to leave their country of origin. All this will come to a head. All this is coming to a head in the central Mediterranean. And we envisage this to be a very, very catastrophic year in terms of crossing and in terms of deaths in the Mediterranean. And what MOAS does and our reason for being is to primarily mitigate loss of life at sea, to save people.
How often do you go out on these missions, or does MOAS go out on these missions, and what do they find?
Last year, the operation was privately funded by Christopher and Regina Cartrambone. So last year, in 60 days of operations, we saved 3,000 people in the central Mediterranean. This year, we will be out at sea as from the 2nd of May, and we will be out at sea for 180 days rather than 60 days.
What are some of those health issues that you guys have encountered in the search and rescue missions?
Last year, we were trying to avoid catastrophic situations, but we still had a lot of situations where people were suffering from hypothermia, particularly towards the end of our deployment in October. So hypothermia, sunburn at the beginning, petrol burns because they are in contact with the fuel that has been spilled on the boat. And then a lot of other problems. We had particular instances, I recall, of coming across a young disabled girl who was diabetic. So that was a huge emergency case. But in general, it all depends on how early you manage to come across and to render assistance. There have been instances where people are lost at sea and they drink seawater. There have been instances, obviously the worst case scenario is when the boat overturns, and you have to keep in mind that every boat is overloaded. Last year, the first incident we came across, it was a 12-meter boat with 271 people on board. Of these 271, over 100 were women and children.
Martin Shreereb is director of the Migrant Offshore Aid Station. He was speaking with Ricky Shryock from Rome.
Waves of migrants continue to arrive on the shores of southern Italy from North Africa. After a dangerous Mediterranean journey, they face an unknown future. VOA's Henry Ridgewell is following the trail of refugees from Africa and the Middle East into Europe. In the Sicilian town of Catania, he found a woman called the Angel of the Migrants.
Among the crowd of Syrian refugees in Catania station, it is the number of children that is striking. There are babies just a few weeks old. These Syrians have fled civil war, and they've just spent up to 20 days at sea in an old fishing boat. Exhausted, with little money and few belongings, they're about to start the next leg of their journey north on the night train to Milan. They bring with them tales of horror from Syria. Ahmad Anwar Fares describes what forced him to flee his home in Reef al-Sham near Damascus. He says they bombed his house, killing his four-month-old daughter when a block of ceiling fell on her. Fares says he has two sons, whom he immediately picked up and fled. There is at least a friendly face waiting in Catania. Nawal Soufi is a Moroccan-Italian woman known as the Angel of the Migrants. She and her friends distribute baby food and clothes, along with words of advice and encouragement. I love you all. You are my family, she says. God bless you and may you achieve your dreams. Soufi is part of a group of activists working along the migrant trail through Italy, known as La Rete, or the Network. Part of their work is helping migrants avoid being exploited by conmen, as Soufi explains. On this particular day, she says, a group of conmen offered to drive them to the north for 500 euros each. She explained to the migrants that they have the right to take a train, that the police cannot stop them. Soufi explains why she is dedicated to helping the migrants. So she can feel like a human being when she gets back home at night, she says. So she does not feel she is a part of the tragedy. So she does not feel she has the blood of these people on her hands. After setting off from North Africa, migrants often call Soufi from a satellite phone so she can alert the Coast Guard. It's earned her the nickname Lady SOS. Earlier this month, up to 900 migrants died when their boat sank off Libya. Soufi says Europe's inaction is an outrage. Is it impossible that Europe cannot guarantee a humanitarian corridor from Syria, with each country taking a share of these migrants, Soufi asks? Europe is considered a group of democratic countries where everyone knows about human rights, although perhaps now that is only known on paper, because 900 people is more than just a number. The migrants at Catania have survived that deadly journey. Now they face new fears and new challenges. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Catania, Italy.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday to Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Ruhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Political tensions continue to rise in the Democratic Republic of the Congo ahead of next year's presidential election, following which President Joseph Kabila's mandate is set to expire. As many as 40 activists, musicians, and journalists were arrested in the capital, Kinshasa, on March 15th during a news conference held to promote greater involvement in national politics by young Congolese. The government accused organizers of inciting insurrection. Intelligence agents and police in the eastern city of Goma also arrested members of the group Struggle for Change, or LUCHA, who peacefully protested the Kinshasa detentions. Four LUCHA members arrested on April 7th are being held in Goma's central prison on charges of inciting disobedience to public authority. Earlier this year, at least 42 people died in Kinshasa and other cities protesting a now-abandoned plan to conduct a national census before scheduling the next elections. Activists said such a move would have allowed the president to remain in office for at least three more years, as the headcount was conducted across the huge, densely forested nation. President Kabila, who has held office since 2001, is constitutionally barred from running for a third term in presidential elections set for November 2016. The DRC struggled through years of war, which claimed more than 5 million lives. Strengthening security and political stability is essential for the future of the DRC and the Great Lakes region. As the DRC enters its electoral cycle, it is especially important that the government uphold the constitutional rights of all citizens to the freedoms of assembly and expression, and ensure that the electoral process is transparent, inclusive, and peaceful. The credibility of an election depends not only on the day votes are cast, but on the entire electoral process. Consequently, the United States is deeply concerned by the ongoing detention, without formal charges or regular access to legal counsel, of youth activists by the government of the DRC. We call on the Congolese leaders to ensure that these detainees and all detainees are afforded full due process and released immediately if no charges are warranted.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Go! What's up, Africa? It's Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
Can I be up front with you?
That's exactly what Nadia and I plan to do every Wednesday at 1730 UTC. Upfront looks at issues that affect you.
Since the world is moving at a faster rate, they need to have a major computer.
Interesting news.
Canadian man was sentenced for drunk driving after being pulled over in his mother's motorized wheelchair. 35-year-old man was fined and placed on probation.
And of course, music. No clouds in my stones. Entertainment, celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it.
And of course, we love to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments. Our email address is upfront@voanews.com.
So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 1730 UTC on The Voice of America.